This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 26th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 131. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. The big deal feature, the empty planes scandal as Canada's pandemic PPE problem reaches new heights and new lows. And hear from disgraced former NBA referee Tim Donaghy, who spoke about the mob and pro basketball on a webinar hosted by Canadian academic and investigative journalist Declan Hill. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who are making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or why are some of British Columbia's highest paid public sector executives not feeling your pain and taking a pay cut? New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern slashed her pay by 20%. Her cabinet and Crown Corporation CEOs followed her lead. In British Columbia, Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart has proposed a 10% pay cut after mass layoffs at City Hall and a 10% pay cut for non-union workers. TransLink CEO Kevin Desmond and senior executives are cutting their pay 10% after laying off more than 1,400 from the Public Transit and Roads Agency. Stewart and Desmond both have their hands out for bailouts. Stewart wants $200 million. Desmond wants enough money to stop the $75 million a month losses at TransLink. Earlier this week, I sent email questionnaires to the heads of BC's Public Service, BC Hydro, BC Lottery Corporation, BC Liquor Distribution Branch, ICBC, BC Pavilion Corporation, and the University of BC. The total pay packages in the most recent year reported ranged from $267,000 for liquor distribution boss Blaine Lawson to $602,000 for University of British Columbia President Santa Ono. BC Hydro CEO Chris O'Reilly is number two on the list at $555,000. I wanted to know what their compensation rate is for this fiscal year and whether they would volunteer to take a temporary pay cut. I also wanted to know what, if anything, their organization has done to cut back since the pandemic ground our economy to a halt. Not a single one replied. I did get a note from Duncan Blomfield, the spokesman for Pavco CEO Ken Cretney. Ken Cretney's total pay package was $473,000. Pavco operates the Vancouver Convention Center and BC Place Stadium. The only thing happening in either building is a field hospital at the Convention Center. Blomfield wrote, and I quote, "As you can appreciate, it is a difficult time for our organization and for the entire meetings and events sectors. We are looking at all options to take care of our people and the viability of our business while working closely with our government about appropriate next steps. When there is new information to share, we will do so." End quote. So far, the only movement on the provincial scene is a voluntary pay freeze for BC MLAs. They decided last month to delay their cost of living increase until further notice. With a recession inevitable and a sequel to the Great Depression a possibility, British Columbians need their highest paid public bosses to tighten their belts. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Lam Ka-sing in the South China Morning Post. Hong Kong developers scale back project launches, slow down construction as demand dries up due to coronavirus outbreak. Construction of new homes falls 77% in the first quarter from the previous three-month period, government data shows. Few takers for Longfor Group and KWG Group's Upper Riverbank project in Kai Tak, as only 8 of the 72 flats are sold. New flat sales have also been interrupted by the government's rule, which bans the gathering of more than 4 people in the same place. Patrick Galloway in ABC News Australia. As online betting booms, even old-school bookmakers are keeping pace. Last week, economics firm Alpha Beta published a report which found online wagering had increased by 67% in the wake of the pandemic. Thousands of retail betting options have closed in the past month, including those within pubs and clubs, traditional street-facing tab outlets, and casinos. In the midst of this pandemic, which saw his entire cash flow wiped out, Bookmaker David Dwyer launched a new digital wagering platform, which has proven to be a winner, but experts worry it could create more losers among the gambling public. Gigi in the Japan Times, Osaka names and shames six pachinko parlors staying open in epidemic. It is the first time that the names of uncooperative businesses have been made public under Article 45 of the Special Coronavirus Response Law. And an update to a story last week from Japan. Fukui kicks off ticket-based mask sales as Abeno mask plan flops. The nationwide shortage continues, the two masks per person being supplied by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's coronavirus initiative have yet to arrive in many parts of the nation since deliveries began last week. Moreover, some of them have been recalled following complaints of defects. Fukui Prefecture began selling masks via numbered tickets to ensure all 320,000 households get an equal opportunity to buy them. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Raker.News podcast. That's from Justin Trudeau speaking moistly by Anani Motif on YouTube. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Brad Schmidt in the Oregonian. How can Oregon reopen amid coronavirus? It may start with 600 new contact tracers. National health experts see increased testing to detect the coronavirus and thorough contact tracing as the country's best bet to reopen shuttered businesses. Oregon's Governor Brown announced stay-at-home restrictions on March 23rd. Those workers would perform contact tracing, specimen collection, and help link people who are under isolation or quarantine to support services. The health authority declined to say how officials arrived at that number or whether the tracers would be hired by the state or individual counties, how much they would cost, or where the money would come from to pay their salaries. Robert Mittendorf in the Bellingham Herald, Whatcom Unified Command change will help coronavirus decision-making and communication. The multi-government agency that's directing local response to the new coronavirus pandemic is getting a single leader and settling in for long-term operations. Scott McCreary, who is Emergency Management and Security Officer for the Port of Bellingham, was named Incident Commander for Whatcom Unified Command. He replaces the three incident commanders and nine other county officials who have been serving as their relief, putting in 12-hour days or more on a rotating schedule since the Unified Command began operating daily on March 18th, about a week after the first COVID-19 cases were reported in Whatcom County and one day before the first death. Sky Ryan of Czech News, First Nations-owned businesses struggling COVID-19 losses. According to Huayat First Nations Councillor Trevor Coots, some First Nations communities are really feeling out in the cold due to COVID-19, especially those with businesses that don't qualify for the national wage subsidy. In Banfield, the Huayat First Nation employs one-third of the West Coast community population. Business has plummeted in the tourist destination due to COVID-19. The Huayat First Nation ensure those 55 employees are still being paid so that their community and families can survive the economic blow of COVID-19. And these headlines this week in the Breaker.News. Email shows BC Premier's office knew medical mask supplies were scarce in mid-February. As cargo jet unloads more PPE, Chinese students distribute consulate imported masks. And man wearing medical mask arrested in downtown Vancouver drug bust. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news.
Wuhan Coronavirus Pandemic 2020.
This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Canada's PPE problem reached new heights last week. Two jets chartered by Canadian taxpayers returned from China empty. They were supposed to be full of masks, gloves, gowns, and other supplies for frontline health workers in the battle against the coronavirus. On April 21st, a clearly embarrassed Prime Minister Justin Trudeau reacted to the news revealed by Conservative leader Andrew Scheer.
We have, I got more information on the issues around the two planes that landed empty yesterday. One was a Government of Canada charter. The other was chartered by a specific province for one of their orders. There are severe restrictions on the ground in China in terms of how long a plane can actually stay in their airports before having to leave, whether it's full or not. And at the same time, supply lines and truck shipments to the airports are difficult and interrupted by checkpoints and quarantine measures. For the most part, we've been able to navigate through those and ensure that Canada has received the equipment that it needs. But these two airplanes were forced to take off empty.
Then came word that a million of them made in China to Chinese standards KN95 masks were unfit for use on the front lines in Canada. Just in time for the April 24th meeting of the House of Commons Standing Committee on Government Operations and Estimates. Liberal Public Services and Procurement Minister Anita Anand repeated talking points for her nearly hour of testimony. Then it was time for Deputy Minister Bill Matthews to be on the hot seat. He said one of the planes was chartered by the federal government and the other by a province. The Breaker.News has learned that the subcontracting province was Ontario. Matthews said the cost of a flight is between $600,000 and $800,000, which means as much as $1.6 million of taxpayers' money was wasted by the empty flights. This is Hamilton Centre NDP's MP Matthew Green.
So we've heard today that this minister has stated that they have no role to play in the national emergency stockpile. We've also heard public health experts suggest that there's going to be multiple waves of potentially COVID in future seasons. My concern is that if we're not adequately preparing for now, particularly in the hyper-competitive purchasing environment, the replenishing of our stockpiling, the insurance that comes, you know, the next wave, that we're adequately prepared, as well as retroactively looking at ways in which perhaps we need to share responsibility if we are responsible for the procurement and the logistics chain right up to when they're being not only delivered, but also when they're being disposed of, because I'm still to understand that under this ministry that there is a responsibility for the distribution of goods before they become expired. And I would like to have better information around that, because there's been a lot of ambiguity.
This is Edmonton West Conservative Kelly McCauley.
So, Mr. Matthews, Mr. Chair, it's a straight yes or no question. Canadian taxpayers have a right to know, have we purchased a million masks that are unsuitable to protect our doctors and nurses and our seniors? Are we getting that money back?
So, Mr. Chair,
and are they going to replace them with appropriate products for Canadians, for our doctors and our nurses, or are we just going to let that money go away? It's a simple yes or no question.
I don't believe it's a simple yes or no question, Mr. Chair. The company is going to supply replacement product to back up the masks. The reason I hesitated on that is it's not a filtration issue. We've got issues with the masks, a large part of them with our elastics. So if they can be used for something else, we will absolutely use them for something else. But these masks never made it into the medical system. To make it in, they have to pass the inspection of PHAC and meet Canadian standards. So our expectation is we are getting replacement product.
At no extra charge.
That is my expectation, Mr. Chair.
How much in total have we spent on items that have not been deemed acceptable for our standards?
So the two examples that are in play from a quality perspective, Mr. Chair, are the swabs, which were arrived and were not sterile, and they were put back into the system after sterilization. And I'm going to turn to Ariane Reza to get an answer on the swab question. But on just to ballpark,
how much should it cost us then to fix those swabs? And are we paying for it, or are the supplier paying for it?
I'm going to have to let Ariane answer the swab question if she can, and if not, we can circle back. On the mask question, you're seeing a range of prices for masks, Mr. Chair. When this crisis started, we were looking at about $1.20 a mask if you had orders early on. More recent orders, you're seeing prices quoted up to $5 and $6 a mask for N95 respirators. So the cost of masks depends on when you placed your order, frankly, and when you had your arrangements in place. And maybe I'll flip to Ariane if she can shed some light on the swabs.
So if the stockpile had been stocked up, we would have saved a lot of money, is what you're saying as well.
Elizabeth May, the Saanich and the Islands Green Party MP, asked Deputy Minister Bill Matthews why Canada was not better prepared to procure medical supplies.
That experience, we were supposed to be paying attention to making sure we had PPE, to make sure we had stockpiles. Now, where was that primary responsibility lodged? Is it in those the department that we're talking to today? Would it have been public health? Can I ask the officials who was primarily responsible for making sure we didn't forget the experience of SARS?
So from a policy type questions or levels of stockpile type questions, Mr. Chair, that would fall squarely in the circles of Health Canada, Public Health Agency of Canada. The role of this department, I think it, most people are aware, is to actually go and procure, but we usually procure when we have a client who will instruct us on just what it is they need.
Thank you. That's very clear and helpful. In terms of what you've experienced since the COVID-19 crisis began, and I think some of the other questions, I think Mr. McCauley was getting at this too. When were you first given instructions that we needed to really bulk up our procurement around PPE?
So the calendar, if we reflect back, you would have seen some minor small orders kind of towards the end of January, early February. The first big order, collaborative one with the provinces. So this is where public health and came in with a big order that involved multiple provinces. You're looking at March 10, March 11th, when we received our first big order. And that would have been done after several weeks of consultation amongst the various health authorities in the provinces, territories, and the federal government.
And as things stand right now, if I can squidge in one last question, as things stand right now, what is the commodity, the product, which gives you the biggest headaches? Which ones are we most likely to experience any shortage, or are you comfortable that we've got what we need for the next few months?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It varies by the week, frankly. So 2 weeks ago or a week ago, if I was here, I would be talking about swabs. That's under control. I think the N95 respirators are one that we are still actively managing. Others, like surgical masks, very much in control. Good supply of good, high-quality masks coming into the system.
MP Matthew Green.
Are you aware of what the minimum supply of the emergency stockpile is, and are there any mechanisms in place that would flag for you whether or not it's reached those critical points, or are you solely relying on PHAC? Because if that's the case, we got a significant problem here understanding what's just transpired over the last year and a half.
And Mr. Matthew, if you can answer that in 10 seconds or less, I'll let you go ahead. Otherwise, I would ask that you give a written response to Mr. Green's question through our clerk.
I will give the 10-second attempt, Mr. Chair. The responsibility for the levels of supply in the stockpile, as well as their upkeep and currency in terms of expiration dates, is 100% in the domain of the public health agency.
And I look forward to having the public health agency before us sometime in the near future.
Thank you very much.
Those were highlights from the April 24th meeting of the House of Commons Standing Committee on Government Operations and Estimates.
Of toilet paper, but rare trips to the loo. All this hoarding was just wrong. What nervous people do. Seeing the world out my window, the right thing to do. Isolation's what I'm in. I got the COVID-19 blues. We should have thought ahead. First China, then Iran. This is my first pandemic. I'm doing all I can. I wash my hands with soap, water, sanitizer too. I douse myself in vodka just to spend some time with you.
The COVID-19 Blues by the Accutones. The voice of the Accutones is Richmond, BC lawyer Paul Doroshenko of Acumen Law. You can find his website, vancouvercriminallaw.com. Tim Donaghy refereed in the NBA for 13 seasons. He was paid up to $400,000 a year. But he threw it all away. Donaghy's career ended, and he was sent to jail for 15 months in 2008. Why? Because Donaghy had bet on his own games, and he was paid by members of the Gambino crime family for inside information. On April 22nd, the former mob-linked referee spoke on a special Zoom webinar held by the University of New Haven's Certificate in Sports Integrity Department. Declan Hill, the Canadian author who runs the department, hosted the webinar. He called Donaghy one of the most controversial figures in the history of the National Basketball Association, a former top referee who was working with the mafia while officiating high-level games. The FBI investigated. Donaghy was jailed, beaten up by the mob. There has been a Hollywood movie about him. However, almost everything that has been said about Donaghy in the media is false, Hill said. Donaghy recalled when he found out his time was up and he was caught.
I totally hit the panic button. I went to a buddy who was an attorney of mine who called the United States attorney who was working the case. I was in his office when he called the United States attorney, and I was on speakerphone with him. And he said, listen, you give Tim Donaghy a message. You tell him that we know what he did, we know who he did it with, and we know how he did it. And it's just a matter of time before we come get him. He's much better off coming to us before we come to him. Because if we have to come to him, not only is he going to lose his job, but he's going to go to jail for a long, long time. With that, I waited about a couple weeks. I had lost 30 pounds in less than 30 days. And I thought it was in my best interest and my family's best interest with everything that had been associated with Batista, who was the guy that was associated with the Gambino crime family, that I should make an appointment and go up and speak to them. I got an attorney. We flew up to New York. They put me in a room. In that room, there was a whiteboard, and it said gambling, 5 to 10 years. Racketeering, 5 to 10 years. Money laundering, 5 to 10 years. I'm sitting in this room by myself, all boxes stacked to the ceiling marked John Gotti trial. So before I could really get my thoughts together, I'm starting to realize I'm in a lot of trouble. With that being said, everybody comes into the room. Phil Scala, who's the supervisory special agent for the investigation into the Gambino crime family, puts his finger right in my face and he says, listen, you're sitting in the same fucking seat John Gotti sat in. I got John Gotti. So if you're going to think that you're going to lie to me, get the fuck up and leave right now. With that being said, of course, I was already in panic mode, but I really went into panic mode. And I told them everything that I did, how I did it, who I did it with, and to the extent of which I did it. With that, after that initial meeting, I became a cooperating witness for the culture of fraud that existed within the NBA and people associated with the Gambino crime family.
How insidious did the corruption become in NBA refereeing? Listen to this.
I'm going to ask the question that is the elephant in the room. You know what's coming down the pipeline now. Everybody wants to know the answer to this. Did you match fix games in the NBA? Aside from sports gambling, did you match fix?
I think that's a great question, and it's a fair question. And here's how I like to answer that. Did I make calls in games that put teams at advantages or disadvantage? Absolutely. But with that being said, the NBA dictated to the referees what they wanted called and how they wanted them called. For example, if there was a seven-game series in the playoffs and a team was up 3-0, they would put the 3 referees or the 4 referees with an alternate into the meeting and go over previous plays that happened in the other games and tell them what they wanted them to concentrate on that night. And it always went in favor of teams that were down in the series and against teams that were up in the series. So with that being said, they were always trying to extend those series in a way that was beneficial to more games, more revenue, and a situation where it would go from 3-0 to 3-1, possibly 3-2, or extended to a 7-game series where, it was more revenue for everybody involved.
Tim, let me unpick this. There's a fantastic book by a guy, Brian Toohey, called The Fix Is In, where he talks about this being systemic. I want to stress that you're talking about the NBA between 2003 and 2008. There have been substantial changes in the NBA since those days. But you're implying that there was a organized systemic corruption to push the series towards the big teams or the big markets. Is this right?
I'm not implying. I'm flat out telling you that we would walk out of those meetings as four referees, three on the floor and an alternate, and say, oh, geez, they really want the Lakers to win tonight, or they really want, you know, the Pistons to win tonight. And I talk about different stories in the book where I'll give you an example where Dallas was playing the Houston Rockets back in the Yao Ming days. And Houston was up, I believe it was 2-0, heading back to Houston. And everyone knows the history of the NBA. If you're up 2-0, you're heading back to your home floor, there's a good chance you're going to win that series. Mark Cuban was so vocal in complaining about Yao Ming traveling in the post, Yao Ming setting illegal screens, that he bitched and complained so much to the league office. That's all they concentrated on in the meetings with the NBA referees. And Dallas went in and won the next 2 games on Houston's home floor and ended up winning in 7 games. So, you know, there's a lot of things that took place in those situations to where, you know, things dictated by the NBA league office, you know, dictated to the referees in a situation where teams were put at advantages and disadvantage. And with that being said, you know, the NBA dictated to us what they want to call it on the floor, and teams were put at advantages.
That was former NBA referee Tim Donaghy and Declan Hill. Hill is the Associate Professor of Investigations at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Science at the University of New Haven in Connecticut. Declan Hill is also the author of The Fix, Soccer and Organized Crime, and The Insider's Guide to Match Fixing in Football. His website is DeclanHill.com.
I did a volunteer stint, soup kitchen this morning. The poorest amongst us are being hurt by people who are hoarding. Grocery stores, surgical masks, sanitizers. So let me just say to those who are trying to exploit others, there must be a special place in hell. A special place in hell. A special place in hell for people like that. There must be a special place in hell.
That's from The Battle of Alberta. Jason Kenney sings Special Place in Hell by Anonymotif on YouTube. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to truck drivers, couriers, bus drivers, ferry captains, and airplane pilots, the people keeping things moving during the coronavirus pandemic. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 26th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on April 26th in 1964, Tanganyika and Zanzibar merged to form Tanzania? I've got some fond memories of visiting Tanzania and meeting the people in 2009 when the Vancouver Whitecaps held their training camp in the African nation. Jambo to Tanzania. That's hello in Swahili. I'll tell you more about that in a future edition. But now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Playing us out is John Mitchell and his Vancouver independent single, Do What? Until next week.
You gotta do what?
What?
Dr. Henry says, we're gonna have to wait to vaccinate. So just stay strong and sing this song. You gotta wash your hands, don't touch your face. Just be kind.